we've been doing these talks on a Friday or other days for about 18 months now. I've been searching around for a subject which we haven't covered, and I chose trade unionism. Not so much what we think of the trade unions, but well, that is what. But what party members do when they're members of trade unions, as members of the trade unions. So I don't want to discuss too much the theoretical stuff about why we need trade unions and why we're active in trade unions. Except I think it will be interesting to explain how the present party position came to be, and the present party position is that party members should be a member of a trade union, and that they all workers in fact should be active trade unionists. I mean, right when the party was formed in 1904, this wasn't evident as the position that would have been taken. It's true that quite a few of the founding members of the party were active in the existing in the then existing trade unions, but there were other views, such as that people that socialists should organise their own union to oppose the existing trade unions because they tended to support capitalism. Now, it was clear that because there were some founding members who were active trade unionists, that the party wasn't really going to adopt the position that party members should not join trade unions or should leave the existing trade unions. Various discussions took place in the year after the founding of the party. And some members favoured forming, as I say, a separate socialist trade union or socialist industrial union. I mean, one member proposed at an early meeting that as soon as the membership reached 5,000, we should form a socialist trade union. That motion fell because there wasn't a seconder. But the issue never really went away, and within a year or so of the party being founded, it came back as a big issue. Now, on the anniversary of the founding of the party, it issued the manifesto of the Socialist Party of Great Britain. Part of it is in slide one. That's the end, but I will read the beginning of it. It says, the basis of the action of the trade unions must be a clear recognition of the position of the workers under capitalism and the class struggle necessarily arising therefrom. In other words, they must adopt the socialist position if they are going to justify their existence at all. Does this mean that the existing trade unions are to be smashed? That will depend upon the unions themselves. And then follows the bit which is on the screen, which I'll read because I think this is being recorded. All action of the unions in support of capitalism or tending to sidetrack the workers from the only path that can lead to their emancipation should be strongly opposed. But on the other hand, trade unions being a necessity under capitalism, any action on their part upon sound lines should be heartily supported. So that was the position that was adopted in the manifesto. But that was issued in June 1905. And a month later in Chicago was founded the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World, which claimed to be just such a class-based revolutionary trade union. I use the word trade union here incidentally in the sense which is used in Britain, which is to mean any union of workers, whether it's an industrial union or a craft union or any form of workers' union, it doesn't necessarily mean craft union, which it might do in America. As I said, this founding of the IWW put the this is slide two, but sparked off again a discussion within the party, because there were people who favoured the formation of a socialist industrial union, and some of them claimed that the IWW was such a union. In fact, if you look at this, this is the original preamble that was adopted in July 1905. It was later changed, but I mean, there's not much in it that party members would have disagreed with. I mean, it says the working class and the employing class have nothing in common. There can be no peace so long as hunger and want are found amongst millions of working people, and the few who make up the employing class have all the good things of life. Between these two classes, a struggle must go on until all the toilers come together on the political as well as the industrial field to take and hold that which they produce by their labour through an economic organisation of the working class without affiliation with any political party. Now, there are not many members of the party who would disagree with, you know, with most of that, because it was saying that the workers should organise both politically and industrially. The only disagreement, incidentally, it would be something which you might not expect, and that is with the last few words, without affiliation with any political party. The members who would have supported this or could have supported this would disagree with that thing, because they thought that any socialist trade union should be affiliated to the Socialist Party. Now, some members, as I said, at the time, were in favour of the IWW, or the party endorsing the IWW, and of trying to form an organisation of the same type in Britain. And the issue was debated on three successive Saturday afternoons in May 1906, of which lots of motions, amendments were voted on and either carried or rejected. There's one motion, which might be surprising, started off, this declares war on existing trade unions and their leaders, urges its members, that's the party members, to advocate the formation of an industrial organization based on the irreconcilable antagonism between the capitalist class and the working class. Their argument was that this, in fact, was what the IWW was. But if you think of the implication of the first part of that, declare war on existing trade unions and their leaders. I mean, there was no problem, of course, with declaring war on the leaders of the trade unions at the time. They didn't claim to be socialists. Most were liberals. Some of them were nonconformist lay preachers. So there was nothing wrong with that. But if you declare war on the unions themselves, that would mean that any party member who was in a trade union would have to leave, because a trade union the party would be hostile to trade unions as they were to all other political parties. The opponents of this, you know, besides making that point, also argue that the IWW, despite its revolutionary preamble, wasn't really a socialist union, because most of the of its members were not socialists. At most, it would be a militant a general union. Now, all the resolutions that were passed at this meeting went to a vote of the membership, and all of them were voted down. So beliefs didn't end up facing two ways. Now, what this meant, of course, that the position remained what it was in the manifesto of 1905, that the party strongly opposed all action of trade unions in support of capitalism and heartily welcomed trade union action on sound lines. But it did have some meaning, because what it meant was a rejection of the view that the existing trade unions should be smashed. It also rejected the view that socialists should form a revolutionary trade union in opposition to the existing unions. These are positions that have been taken by other organisations, for instance, the left communist, so-called international communist current, does say that the existing union should be smashed because they see them as part of the state machine. And the second thing that was that wasn't accepted was that workers should form, socialists should form their own trade union. In other words, you should form a revolutionary trade union to rival the existing trade unions. I mean, this was known as dual unionism, and it was at the time the policy of the Socialist Labour Party of America. And again, in the 1920s, it was the policy of the Communist Party, and it was always the policy of the IWW. Well, always. It's no longer the position of the IWW. They now do permit their members to join the existing unions. So anyway, the outcome was that the position of working within the existing unions was endorsed. I mean, I was going to say naturally, but it did lead to a split, and some prominent members, founding members, did leave to either join the Socialist Labour Party or support an organisation to set up an IWW in Britain. Actually, I can mention that in passing that the IWW also split, and eventually all reference I'll bring up slide two again. All reference in the constitution to political action was eliminated. It became an anti-political organization, if you like. It became a syndicalist union. As I said, the original manifesto talked about action, supporting action on sound lines. But what was action on sound lines? I think one of the resolutions that was passed at the meeting is slide three, which I think puts the case quite well as to why not just socialists but workers should join trade unions. I'll have to read it for the recording. That as under capitalism, the workers sell their labour power, inseparable from themselves as an article of merchandise, and being subject to the same economic laws which prevail in other commodity markets, it is necessary for the workers to debate the fluctuations in the price with the employers. Organised action being more advantageous than in individual action, be it resolved that the SPGB holds that trade unionism is a necessity under capitalism to prevent the workers being continuously driven to sell the labour power below its value. So that I think that's quite a good argument or a good expression of what our position was, even though in fact it was part of a resolution which wasn't endorsed in the party poll. But it really reflects what the 1905 manifesto said. Just as a curiosity, slide four is another part of that resolution, which might surprise some members here. This is how it reads: that as the establishment of socialism will mean the administration of things instead of the government of people, as Engels said, and as the administration of the various detailed processes of wealth production can only be carried on effectively by those possessing the requisite technical knowledge being organized for that purpose, be it resolved that the SPGB holds that trade unionism is necessary for the establishment of socialism. I mean, that is still the official party position, even though we don't emphasize it all that much. Before going on to say or work out what would be regarded as sound and unsound trade union action, I need to mention one more event that happened in that period. It's the so-called Osborne Judgment of 1909. Now, Osborne was the branch secretary of the Amalgamated Society of Railway Servants, and he was a liberal, and he objected to the union's funds being used to finance the Labour Party. It went to court, and he won, which meant that from that point on, if people wanted to support the trade unions wanted to support the Labour Party, they would have to opt in to paying the political levy. I mean, this was reversed by an act in 2000 in 1913, but it was restored again after the general strike, and then it was overturned again, so that you had to opt out as the post-war Labour government. So naturally, of course, members of the party opt out of paying any money to the Labour Party. Now I think we can look at the last slide I've got here, which is the slide five, which I think is trying to sum up what would be regarded as sound and what would be regarded as unsound action by the trade unions. I mean, the first point would be that, on sound action, that the struggle at work over wages and working conditions is part of the class struggle. In other words, it's different from other negotiations and dealings that workers might have, like buying a second-hand car or discussing the rent. It isn't just an argument, a commodity struggle. It's actually a class struggle. And the second point is that trade union organization and action should be democratic, with decision-making power in the hands of the members or those on strike, not union officials. The point about those on strike is that they're the people who should decide when to go back and on what conditions, not union officials. The third point is that trade union organization action should not promote the interest of one section of the workers at the expense of the other. I mean, this is obvious, but a lot of trade unions are sectional organizations which push the interest of their members, even at the expense of other members of the working class. I mean, one example would be opposition to women workers working in the factories or on the buses after the war, not to say objections to Pakistani and people from the West Indies, working on the buses, which was manifested from time to time. And the fourth point is what I've just made about the Osborne judgment. The trade union should not support or be affiliated to any political party. In other words, that socialists in the union should oppose affiliation to the Labour Party. So that is the how the party arrived at its present position. But what do we do in practice? Well, I'll start by saying what I did when I was in various trade unions in the course of my working life. And maybe afterwards other people can say what they did or what they thought of doing. But the first union that I was a member of was NATSOPA, which is the National Association of Operating Printers and Assistants. This wasn't because I was an operating printer or an assistant. I was working for a national newspaper, and the white-collar workers working for national newspapers were in a union, and it was one of the print unions. And I think this made sense, that because you have one employer, you should have one union to face them. In other industries, office workers were not in the same union as the shop floor workers, but in the national newspapers they were. I should mention, I don't quite know, there were about six or seven or even more printing trade unions at the time, but the one which got the franchise was NATSOPA. So as a trade unionist, I also took part in a sort of inter-trade union rank and file committee, which was arguing for one single union for the print industry. I mean, while I was there, the NATSOPA did an argument with another union. I can't remember what its name was now, but it was the union that delivered the paper to the printers and also delivered the papers, to form a union called SOGAT, which is Society of Graphic and Allied Trades. This actually didn't last for very long. It split after two or three years. But many years later, in 1991, there is now a single union for the printing trade. It's actually called the Graphical Media and Paper Union. and pleasing. In fact, he actually got the title, the word union in his title, and didn't come up with some silly title like some unions have today, like amicus or prospect or community or even unison for that matter. At the time, there was a Labour government, and it imposed a wage freeze, and the unions had an agreement with the employers that if the cost of living went up by so many points, there would be an increase in wages. For the employers to have paid this would have been contrary to the government's policy, but the unions insisted that they did, and the union did pay. The employers did pay the wage increase, but the next week the Labour government brought in a statutory instrument taking away this wage increase, and it's the only time in my life when I suffered a decrease in my money wages, and it was made by a Labour government. And I've kept a letter from, I've still got a letter from my employer of the time saying this, which I've always waived to show that why nobody should ever vote. No worker or trade union should ever vote for the Labour Party. So one consequence of this was that other members of the union, in fact, of the what was called an amusing title, I thought, the clerical chapel, that's hundreds or thousands of members. We voted that the union should disaffiliate from the Labour Party. I mean, it was only a resolution. It was never going to happen, but it correctly expressed the feelings of workers at the time as to what the Labour government had done of their wages. It also had an effect, incidentally, on this rank and file group that I was in campaigning for one union for the print industry. As you might expect, the Trotskyists were in favour of affiliating to the Labour Party, and the syndicalists and me were opposed to it. Now, the next union I joined was called at the time the Clerical and Administrative Workers Union. That was led by a right-wing leader who later became one of the knights of the TUC Round Table. It was also anti-communist. Members of the Communist Party weren't allowed to hold office. But the branch I was in fact, was full of members of the Communist Party because it also organised the staff who worked at the Communist Party head office. I mean, I had an amusing time in the local branch meetings opposing the various resolutions reformist resolutions that the Communist Party members proposed. Now, the leaders of the CAWU had an ambition of leading a larger union. And they decided to change the name to the Association of Professional, Executive, Clerical and Computer Staff. I'm sure you get significance of it. It's APEX. In other words, they were now going to expand the union by trying to get in middle management, and they neglected the interests of the existing ordinary office staff. I'm sure this was carried at a conference, but it was carried by acclamation, and people knew that if it had been carried by a card, it would have been defeated on a card vote. But at the conference, all the new T-shirts with APEX were there, so the opponents didn't insist. But this campaign to recruit middle management involved in competition with another trade union, which was called the Association of Scientific, Technical, and Managerial Staff, otherwise known as the Foreman's Union. Anyway, these two unions, were in useless competition with each other to try to organise the same group of workers. In the end, at the present time, APEX ended up in the GMB, and the other union ended up is what now called Unite. Now, the last union that I was in was when I went to work in Belgium. Now, there was a completely different situation. The unions are not organised as in Britain along trade or craft or grade lines, but along political lines. I mean, there was a a union affiliated to the Socialist Party, what's called the Socialist Party, was the Socialist Inverted Commas Union. There was a Catholic union, and there was also in Belgium, not in the place where I worked, a liberal union. But in the place where I worked, there was also a staff association. Now, obviously, no socialist is going to join the staff association where there's a bona fide trade union, and it would be impossible, well, at least for me anyway, to join a Catholic union. So I had to join the socialist union, inverted commas, which happened to be also the biggest union. I mean, union activity there was an elected staff committee, and elections to the staff committee were like political elections. Each union or had its list of candidates. There was canvassing. As I say, it was just like a political election. The system was proportional representation. In fact, in the staff committees, the Catholic Union and the Socialist Union, inverted commas, worked together as we did on wage matters. I mean, I in fact did become the secretary and the president eventually of the Luxembourg branch of this union, which I wouldn't have done normally because I was in a situation where there wasn't a socialist branch or socialist activity. I decided that the thing to do was to get involved in trade union activity. If that hadn't been the case, I wouldn't have done that because I remember the late comrade Jack Bradley saying that there are plenty of people who are not socialists who can make good trade unionists. But if you are a socialist, what you should concentrate on is socialist activity, not on trade union activity. As I say, that's being an isolated. That's why I became so active in the union at the time. Anyway, that's my class war record, and over now to others to give theirs. And their experience and ideas about the Socialist Party members' activity. Okay, Chairman, that's it.